Welcome to the Exceedingly Podcast, where we shine a light on the good works God is doing through Christian business people, authors, speakers, and pastors, and talk about practical ways we can all let our lights shine and glorify Christ on earth. Sean Mice here with Larry Onan. Larry, I am just delighted to have you here on the podcast today.
Well, it's good to be with you today too, Sean. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Yeah, awesome, awesome, awesome. Well, before we get started, obviously, Larry Onan, he and his wife served a full-time staff at Campus Crusade for Christ for 18 years. And Larry, it's absolutely amazing to me the work that you've also done in Christian fundraising and been involved in, you know, so many different aspects of that. And as we get ready to kick off, I'll kick off kind of the big question for you. The thing that comes to mind, though, is, you know, so often on one side of this, we don't realize how important fundraising is and money is to get the gospel and to get the people into the world or into the colleges or, you know, even to fund our churches. The money's really important. And so what the work that you've done is just been absolutely amazing, and reading some of your book and seeing the groundbreaking stuff that you did. God did some amazing work.
Well, I'm always amazed to look back and say, oh my goodness, I did that. I didn't know that was going on. That's always hindsight is better. You never know what you got looking at forward speaking.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we kind of get going here, Larry, obviously I have great respect for what you've done, and I'm honored that you would be here on the show with me. The big question that I'm asking folks right now, because I'm seeing a big picture, God's been showing me some things, as I'm sure he has been you as well. How do you see your impact shifting over the last few years as the internet is becoming such a more important component of us getting the word out?
Well, you know, I spent 30 years traveling face to face with people worldwide. I've probably been in about 35 countries. I started off in one local location and developed a program of fund development from just two people to a team of 125 in seven departments. And through that process, it would lead me to answer questions that people had from overseas. But the only way to get to them was getting on an airplane and traveling to South Africa or to Zimbabwe or to Nairobi or to someplace in Europe or Asia or Latin America. And I did a lot of that. I spent 60% of my time traveling the last 30 years of my life before I formally retired. But what I've discovered with the technology in the last decade is amazing how I can be in my home and still be touching the same people's lives, either by, typical emails, which is one way, because once you build a relationship, you can do a lot, or by the use of technology, Zoom, and different kinds of forums. And although I periodically still travel and I'm still connected, and I've been mentoring people on all these different continents for a long period of time, nowadays we can literally schedule an hour and spend an hour together, and neither one of us are putting out much resources. I do believe the face-to-face is very important to genuine relationships. So there's only so much you can do even through a technology stream. But once you've been face-to-face, much of it is, from there on forward, just a relational piece of what happened before. So I mentor a guy in Northern Ireland. I've got a good friend that's doing some great things out of Switzerland. I've got a guy in the middle of Africa that I'm in touch with quite regularly. You know, just situations like that. And it always works out where, because of what we did in the past, we don't really need to be face-to-face because we have already bonded that face-to-face connection. And I think the internet is just, you know, what's happened in the last 10 years is phenomenal. We never dreamed what we would be doing today a decade ago. I retired 10 years ago, and I retired from travel as much as anything else. And it was soon after that, it became more and more a continuity of let's talk, let's get together, let's set a time, let's find the time. And although I can still go in to see him face to face, and I love doing that, there is really, that's a secondary reason. That's just the bonded relationship now. But in terms of content and interaction, there's, it's amazing what has been able to, it's made my life a lot easier. And I could be a lot more places right from my office in California. So I'm a big fan of it. This last spring, I started looking into podcasts and being guests on podcast shows. And I've done probably 18 to 20 of those by now. And again, I'm meeting new people, new audiences, new things, but I'm still doing it from one location. And it makes life much easier. And yet you can sure do an awful lot of dialogue and interaction, either by voice or ideally with voice and video. So I'm a big fan of it because it makes life so much easier than my 30 years of traveling and catching airplanes every place.
That's awesome. Thanks for sharing that perspective. You know, I just find it so efficient, right? Mm-hmm. We can be in, you know, today I'm doing five podcast interviews. If I was using the airplane, that would either take 5 days or it would take, you know, a private jet to make that happen in 2 days.
That's right. And you'd be exhausted.
And I'd be exhausted. And I won't be exhausted today. And really to God be the glory. Let me ask you this. Obviously, God has put some things on your heart. He's gotten you doing, my goodness, this year, 18 podcast interviews. You've got a message inside of yourself. You're able to pour into the next generation. What do you feel like right now is the greatest need among Christian, pastors and speakers that are boots on the ground? What is their biggest challenge right now that you're able to see and pour into?
Well, in working with a lot of Christian leaders, and both, this is going way back into the mid-70s and early 80s when this all started happening. In fact, I'll give you the illustration. I was in a position, I loved another kind of a job. I was putting music groups together for the ministry that I was with. I had 8 traveling groups, and I got an assignment to find 48 music groups and get them all to Dallas, Texas for 1 week for a conference of 100,000 people. And I was responsible to get all the music there. So I had everything from Jerome Hines of the Metropolitan Opera to Larry Norman and Johnny Cash on the other side of the spectrum. And we brought Love Song and Children of the Day from the Jesus People in from Costa Mesa. And I had one guy working with me, and we were responsible for picking those groups. And I loved what we were doing. I loved the energy. I have a background in theater arts. I was going to go into the theater business before I had a radical transformation at the University of Colorado. And so I thought I was in something that was in my sweet spot forever. And during one of the concerts in Dallas, Texas, I heard a new announcement over the PA in front of 80,000 people. They were announcing the new music director of the organization. And that was me, and I was running the stage show that night. And I thought, something's happened out here in the last 24 hours. I lost my job. And I went about 8 weeks, really not knowing what I was going to do next, because I never returned even to my offices in that environment. And yet I was asked by the vice president of the organization to help him with a need. And I was introduced to a guy 15 minutes before my appointment with the vice president. We get to his office together. I'm brand new to him. He's new to me. The vice president says, I've got a problem. While you were running the stage show in Dallas, Texas, there was a large international pledge made for funding. And we had a pledge of $1.9 million. But Larry, all these pledge cards are sitting in my bathtub behind the shower curtain, and they've not been touched in 90 days. Do you think you could take those boxes, open them up? Is there anything valuable at all in a pledge that's 90 days old and nobody has even opened the boxes? And that was my introduction to fundraising. I think there's a misconception out there that fundraising is what people need to do. And I did that for a couple of years. It's not a sinful act, but fundraising always, almost every time you see it happening, has got an exchange involved. You do this for me, I'll do this for you. There is always an exchange. So if you're doing a golf tournament, you play golf, I get some money. You come to my event and you spend $250 for my gala event and you get a free meal and I get something out of you. You're going to make a pledge. So there's an exchange all the time. Even in the political scene in the last 8 to 10 weeks here in the United States, you give money, I'll send you a hat. Or if you're into children's welfare, you send money, I'll send you a blanket. There is always an exchange. A few weeks ago, I wanted a hat. I gave $75 to my favorite charity in terms of political charity, if you want to call it that. I don't call that really a charity, but I gave money not because I was 100% convinced of what they were doing was right, but I wanted one of those hats. And I thought, well, you should be generous, Larry. You've not given money for about 6 months. So go ahead and write him a check a little bit bigger than you normally would. But it really wasn't about the mission. It was about the hat. Now, ironically, I've not received my hat yet. So that may be in the works someplace out there. But it was an exchange. So fundraising is always exchanging. I got into fundraising, and it was 2.5 years later that I woke up with a reality that I could be doing fund development. Fund development is helping people become partners in the mission and being focused on the mission and partnership. I don't see a person that gives money any different than the person that's on the front line doing the actual work. They are equally involved, and one can't do it without the other. So it's not a like, I'm going to get my money and go run. I'm going to be taking your resources and investing them so that you and I are both in doing this together. It's a together business all the way. I didn't know that going into it. Nobody told me what I was to be doing. I had the freedom to fail. And I had a guy that was I was reporting to, and he said, Larry, go try it. If it doesn't work, just go try it again. Nobody cares. You will figure out how to do it, but you have to have the freedom to fail for you to figure out how it's going to happen. So I learned the freedom to fail. I learned that fund development through that particular process I was going through was really what I wanted to do. But that was because, Sean, I was in a meeting and I was the low man on the totem pole. I was not a director of anything other than I was being successful in seeing money come in. And they knew that, and they were having a topic about raising multiple millions of dollars of money. So they decided, well, Larry's been into that area for a year and a half. I guess we should invite him along. Maybe he's got something to contribute, or it may impact what he's doing. That's what I was concerned about is, what are you going to come up with that will impact what I'm already doing? And we had some consultants that had been hired by the organization, and they said, yes, you can raise the money. The amount of money we were wanting to raise was $1 billion. And they said, yes, that money can be raised. But if you don't teach biblical stewardship, you're going to create competition rather than collaboration, because they're going to see you taking the money by aggressive tactics. And the money that they thought might come to them is going to go to you. But if you teach biblical stewardship, then you're going to open up an acreage, thousands of acres of more people that want to give because of the cause, and everybody's going to be blessed. Well, the organization I was with was really not wanting to start another ministry about stewardship. And the consultants were very, very specific. This has to happen or you're going to have real trouble raising the resources. In the middle of it, somebody said, well, you know, Larry's had quite a good success in the last year and a half. Let's assign him to look into what biblical stewardship is and report back to us. I knew immediately it was a tactic to get off of the discussion. It was not about me being really assigned to do anything. But I wrote down on my yellow pad of paper that day, Larry, figure out what lifestyle biblical stewardship is. And at the bottom of the page, I wrote down, and you've got the freedom to fail. That's all I had on my paper. I'm a high responsibility person in my strengths. So about 3 weeks later, nobody was asking me how I was coming. And I thought, I've got to start working on this. I got to figure out what in the world we were talking about, because nobody in the room knew what lifestyle stewardship was. Stewardship to most people was that's the preaching of the sermon to get money in the door annually. And you do series of messages and you talk about getting people guilty and they make a pledge and they do more. That was what stewardship was at the time. When I got into my study on that with a team of guys that I pulled out of my office, I said, we got to figure this out. And as we got into it, we realized that we were really misled of what stewardship was. And we realized that stewardship was a responsibility of someone else taking care of somebody else's resources. In other words, I don't own anything, but I'm entrusted with everything. Because I don't own it, I'm responsible to the steward, the head of the stewardship, the one that owns it, and how I spend it, how I use it, what I do with it. So in my case, I don't own a house. Now, I know the state of California says I do. I know the state of California taxes me on my car. They send me things of that nature. I'm legally a fiduciary on my property, but I don't really own it. I don't own the clothes I wear. I don't own anything. I'm entrusted with a lot of things that I can enjoy, but none of it's mine. When we started realizing the five key principles of biblical lifestyle stewardship, it started changing everything we did. We no longer allowed anybody in our department to call fundraising, meeting, and working with donors. That's a term that's out there today, donors. Donors are people that get stuck with a needle, get drawn blood, and get a sugar cube in exchange. That is what donors are. You're extracting out of them. A partner is one who does this. It joins hands, and it's equally walking into that mission together, and I can give resources, and you can give expertise, and together we accomplish the goal. I'm accountable to the people that give, just like they're holding me accountable to carry out the mission. It was a life-changing experience, and that's what really moved us from two people and 29 boxes of pledge cards to a department of seven different departments and 125 people, and we were helping people give their stewardship, and they were partnering with a ministry, and we were helping other ministries because they were curious about what we were getting done that was so successful. And it really became a life changer. And I spent, 18 years of my life with one organization and another 30 years working with probably 20 or 25 organizations worldwide, and all a part of it, not all of it, because there's tactics and there's process to this whole thing. But at the foundation is, how do you think of the people that are going to be giving? And are you thinking of them as somebody you can extract something or manipulate something from? Or can you see them as partners walking with you in your mission? Whether it's helping kids in the street or a food kitchen, or World Vision, you just name the organization. How they view the people that give is going to make a great deal of difference to how they take care of people. And that's what really became transformative. So your question early on is, what's on your mission? And I wasn't planning on getting into another book, but I was in Ireland about 3 years ago, and I was with a group of leaders from Europe. And they commented that there was nothing that they could easily put into the hands of people that gave them the core principles of what we all knew was true. And they were scrambling to try to find something that was biblical, that was practical, that could be implemented. And I left that meeting in Ireland and I said, I've got to dust off the content that I worked on for years and put it into a format that anybody, any place in the world could get to. And so I came up with the most recent book I wrote called Intentional Living and Giving, because it really takes the core things I learned in the early 80s. And I'm trying to write it for the millennials and the Z generation that have got responsibility to implement things in the future. And so I've given them 9 chapters on what the theology is, and I've given them about 9 chapters on practicality of how you make it work. So my mission is, can I help you get out of distress and feeling depressed and full of anxiety as an individual? And can I help you see biblically how you can live a life that's thriving every day? Now, that's on the pure partner side. I want the ministries and the people that lead ministries to think, how do I see people all the time as partners and not try to extract something from them through manipulation and words and leverage and all the things that are out there? Like I said, fundraising is not sinful, but it's not the optimum way to go. And if you can help people be free in their spirit and understand who they are in God's eyes and what they need to do to be maximized, man, life can be every day I'm blessed because I'm just continuing to give myself away all the time. That's what it's all about. So, you know, my mission, you know, when I'm looking at 80 years behind me, yes, I gained some wisdom over that time. But if anything I can leave for somebody else in the future is the core understanding of how to develop effective partnerships through stewardship. That's a long ways around the bone, but that's really kind of what I get. I'm really into. Now I have other things that interest me too. I got grandkids. I've got a series of children's books that I collaborate with my brother in Colorado. I've got other things that go on, but at the core of all that is taking what God has given to me and passing it on to other people. So
well, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. And really, I think we know that to be God's way, right?
You know, I think we know it's God's way. For instance, I mentioned the first principle, God owns it all. There's everybody, every pastor, whether no matter where you're at on the spectrum of theology, you've all talked about God owns it all. But do they talk about connecting God owns it all with the fact that God is a giver and God wants us to give hilariously, not cheerfully? And the King James, he uses the word cheerful. That's a smile on your face. You know, that's not the way. The word hilaros is a word that means to cause to shine like the sun. The sun is made for one thing. It's made to put off heat and light. It's gas. It's all bright gas. If God wants us to give hilariously, he wants to do the very nature of what he's doing. He's a giver. God so loved the world. We all got that verse down. God so loved the world that he gave his only. Okay, that's giving. And God wants us to be hilarious givers like he is. He also wants us to be asking others, people to people, asking each other, encouraging one another. That's part of the principles of giving, is being able to ask. It's not I've never asked anybody for a dime as a beggar. I'm asking them to be involved in the mission. That's exciting. And then you move into understanding the laws of the harvest, because if you don't understand the laws of the harvest, you're not going to realize that there is process to everything that you do. No farmer plants and then forgets his crop. I just put new seed in my backyard for some grass that was not growing all summer. Every day I'm out putting a little bit more water on that, so that the water can become the activator of the seeds, and the seeds begin to grow in the fall and winter season of my life. If I don't take care of those seeds and manage them correctly, they will do nothing. They will be destroyed. So there is a process of understanding the laws of the harvest. And it's not a manipulation of I'll give to you X dollars so that I can be blessed. Now, you know, blessing is going to come as a result of the harvest. But it's not that I'm using it to get. I'm using it to give, to get, to give, to get, to give, to get, to give, to get. And then, of course, the most probably valuable one is the opportunity to give from God's abundant supply, because God wants us to, he wants to work through man. And if we don't understand how he does that, then we kind of lose the tenaciousness to say, okay, you're the supplier. How do you want to work through me to make that happen? So you combine all those things and all of a sudden you've got a plan. And if I'm a steward, my job is just to implement the plan. And I call it in the book I created, it's called the Authorized Wealth Distributor. You're authorized to distribute God's wealth and resources on call, anytime, anywhere. Now, if you really think you are, now you've got a mission. And your mission in life is to get up this morning and say to yourself, what am I going to do to give myself away today? What am I going to do to help somebody else thrive and also succeed? So it's a fun trip. Sean, I've been very blessed. That doesn't mean life is not easy and has been difficult at times. We sometimes think that our suffering, quote unquote, is where God is punishing us, but God uses probably suffering more than any other way to help us grow. A person that goes running every morning does not do it just because he loves to see things fly by. He's doing it because of health and other reasons. And he's increasing muscle strength and he's increasing discipline to do those kind of things. And It's through that sometimes pain that you end up feeling, okay, now I've succeeded again. I can run a marathon. I can do other things. So even the downside of life, if you're looking at it correctly, can be full of great benefit if you see how the big picture handles it. So I'm more excited about that kind of stuff.
Yeah. You know, that's awesome. With suffering, you know, the thing is, the only thing that ever comes close is intense discipline. And most humans have a difficult time with intense discipline. And, you know, suffering, if it doesn't go away on its own, right? If we just have to go through it with time, we have to grow through it with maturity. And, you know, some things just happen in the natural and it takes time. And however God's using that, then it forces us to grow. It's the only thing. I think that suffering, you know, somebody that has never been through suffering or that has not been through suffering in a particular area, they could study in a book, they could be as disciplined as possible. They can't truly speak into somebody else that's suffering if they haven't been.
You've got to experience it. People try to avoid it. They try to live a life that's cushy. 10 years ago, my wife died of a glioblastoma brain tumor. Now, I'm not encouraging everybody to look for a brain tumor to live life with, but it was 18 months of a new experience. It was kind of a big gulp. I think I was numb half the time working through it. The thing about a glioblastoma is it is definitely guaranteed to be terminal. There is nothing that they can do to stop the glioblastoma. You can live anywhere from 6 months to 10 or 15 years, but you will die of a glioblastoma. So when you look at our political figures, Ted Kennedy, Beau Biden, Senator McCain, all died of glioblastomas. And when it attacks the brain, you know, now you're just processing and learning to live with a new reality. And then eventually, 18 months later, in my particular case, she transferred her address to heaven. Well, I could have taken a suffering point of view and, oh, woe was me, I don't know what to do next. Or I could have said, okay, now I'm here and she's there. She was my administrative assistant. I've got to learn to do what she did well, and that's still a challenge. But, you know, other than that, all I've done is she's just taken a different address. I haven't lost anything. I hated it when people says, I'm so sorry about your loss, because I didn't lose anything. I just knew that she moved addresses. But I think there was a choice that I made to say, I'm not going to let this tear me down. I'm not going to live in the past. I'm not going to live with regret. I'm going to live as if God planned it this way. And we're all promised that, you know, on our appointed time comes, we go. Okay. I accepted that pretty early on. I had friends that say, Larry, when you crash, I'm going to be there for you. I never crashed because I had a different viewpoint and I had work to be done. I had something I needed to continue to do. I'd already learned the principles of lifestyle stewardship. So I knew I was here to continue to accomplish what my wife and I were committed to for many years before. So yes, the suffering was there. The sense of what do you do without your best friend is there. And there is an adjustment of life, because sometimes that person picks up a lot of your weaknesses and does well in her strengths. But I think if we look at anything, you know, I was, you know, in my tenure of life, I was fired 3 different times from the job, fired in an organization that doesn't fire anybody. But what they do in that organization is they move me around. I was really doing something I liked and I got switched to another place. Every one of those switches benefited me big time. So I tell people all the time, never, ever burn your bridges. You may need to walk across that bridge someday. It's not worth the battle to burn the bridge. And many times burning bridges is conflict of neighbors, or I won't talk to you because you have a political view that's different than mine. Don't burn the bridges. You may need that relationship someplace else, and they may become very valuable to you 3 to 5 to 10 years later. And I think, again, it's because they're a steward and I'm a steward and we have a disagreement, rather than they're wrong and I'm right and we really have the disagreement because I know what's best. I have opinions, but it's not worth me destroying a relationship over losing that. And So, you know, that's part of it's life is full of those kind of things. I think many times people think that life is a straight line, and it's not. It's full of curves. And it, how you navigate the curve determines if you're going to drive off the road or make the curve. And we find many people driving off the curb many times because they fell asleep or they weren't paying attention. That curb is there to benefit you so that you learn how to manage the car as you take that curve. And you can drive the same speed, but you've got to be alert to the curve. And life is full of curves. You're going to have to be learning every day. I learn something almost every day that I didn't know the day before. And, you know, they're big things, they're little things, they are fun things, they're not so fun things, but that's what life is.
You know, the thing is, behind it all, God's the master architect. And he knows what you're going to need a year from now. And he knows what you're going to need a week from now. He knows the person you're going to need for the thing that he has going to place for you to be a steward in. He knows all of those things. And, you know, I think about opinions. You know, it's such a shame because, you know, Christianity is so fractured. You know, not only denominations, but the things that people think and the things that they grew up thinking, they hold them as their own. And then because they follow Jesus, must be Jesus's. And so, you know, so easy for us to take something we disagree on and then split our relationship. How does that make Jesus feel when his sons are fighting over it?
If he ever gets sad, he gets sad over our inability to learn from the lessons he provides us in life. Mm-hmm. And I think that we're fearfully and wonderfully made. And I didn't really understand what that was. You know, I was bouncing through life as a teenager. I got into theater. I knew I was going to become famous in the art. I was at the University of Colorado majoring in theater. And I came into a very meaningful connection with God, even though I was a preacher's kid and I was a believer, but I found my peers that were really excited about Jesus. And that radically changed where I ended up going. And I ended up going into a ministry oriented thing. But even that change was pretty dramatic. And I thought, okay, now I'm doing the very thing I never wanted to do, going into cult ministry. Well, I looked back at my life a few years later and I started realizing that the way I put my train set together at 5 years of age was telling me a lot about how I do things. Now, 5 years of age and a train set around a Christmas tree, or eventually I had a huge layout of a, you know, Lionel train set. I didn't really like running the train. I love the idea of designing the train and the tracks and where it went. And then once I got it working well, I changed it around because I got bored running the train around the track. That has stuck with me from the year 5 years of age when I realized that, all the way through my life, because I have always been a creator of taking something from nothing and making it into something. God was working on forming my character when I was 5 years of age for what I would be doing for the rest of my life. And I didn't see that. I did see it creep up at other times. In theater, I started enjoying the directing more than I did the acting. Now, I was in a lot of shows, but the directing let me take something from nothing in a book and create a show in 6 weeks. And by getting people to act and getting the right people to design the set and doing all the right things, we produce something from virtually nothing. And then we would start over and do it again. Well, my life has been full of that. So in a consulting environment with Christian nonprofits, I walk in sometimes to a blank slate or chaos. And I'm taking something from nothing and building it into something that is healthy and productive and will do something. Now, I learned that at 5 years of age, but I didn't know I was learning it at 5 years of age. The way I was wired and the way God made me is different than the way he made anybody else. Now, that doesn't mean people can parallel me and we can collaborate, but I know I'm fearfully and wonderfully made for a purpose. And when I realize that God has got me there working under his management and control, and I don't own anything, but I get the blessings of everything. Suddenly I'm thinking, okay, I can do this. I can make this work. So when I, you know, came back 3 years ago and started to work on the book again, I'm thinking I'm taking something from nothing again ideas and concepts, and they've got to come out in a book. So 3 years later, the book's there. Now, what are we going to do? Well, technology allows us to talk about getting more people involved in the book. It is still taking the something from nothing and continuing to create from it. You know, so, you know, if people are struggling out there listening to your community that listens, God is not done with you yet. And everything in your life in the past, it was put there for a purpose so that you would be maximized for what you're going to do tomorrow. And if we start seeing that clearly in God's economy, all of a sudden, I'm just a lifestyle of doing his thing. I'm his steward, doing stuff with his material, accomplishing his goal and purpose. And of course, I'm very interested in people knowing Jesus personally. But to get to that particular point of the expression of changed life, sometimes there's work to be done to get a person ready for that. And how do we get those people ready? How do we express love for the unlovable? How do we do the difficult thing when we'd prefer it not to be difficult? So yes, I'm kind of I feel like I got another 15 years left and I'm going to push it as hard as I can. So that's what I'm up to. I figure there'll become a time when I'm going to lay down and say that I think I've had enough, and then I'm going to be anticipating, well done, thou good and faithful steward. But in the meantime, I'm not sweating that moment. I'm sweating that, what can I do it today? What can I do to help a listener in your community have a changed life as a result of our conversation today? Can I get you on track? Can I get you to go to the app and get Hallow? And I'm not Catholic by my background, but Hallow is getting you to talk to God in prayer, discipline, intentional living in prayer. How can I get you to do intentional Bible study? Can I get you to listen to your pastor differently? Or can I get you to go to Back to the Bible's excellent resources to help you grow spiritually every day? You know, I see all these activities out there. I want to plug you into the place that you grow. That's what I'm interested in doing. And if I can have a little piece of that, that's a rewarding piece for me, because now you're a changed agent as well.
That's beautiful. You know, what comes into my mind, Larry, and you know, I've talked about this some lately, is that, you know, you and I are talking, and you know a whole lot of Christian leaders, and I know a lot of Christian leaders. And I think God is specifically putting messages just like this into millions of Christian leaders right now. Each one of us, just once a day or a few times a week, was able to do or to share what you just shared. And there's millions of touches every single day. How many hundreds of millions of people can grow closer to Christ every single year? Not because you're talking to a million people, not because I'm talking to a million people, because each one of us is talking to those folks that we have an opportunity to, whether it's on a podcast, whether it's on an interview, you know, wherever, or in the book. It just blows my mind right now what God is doing on a grand scale.
Well, there's a real core principle there, Sean, is it's God to people and people to people. He touches my life. He's expecting me to do for what he does in my life, me to do into my sphere. And so if it's God to people and people to people, it's not God to the universe through the internet. It's God to the person. Last week, I was in a small group study, and an elderly lady across our table said, I got something for you, and she handed it to the friend on my side of the table. And the lady had been through a lot of frustration the last 2 weeks. She'd moved her mother-in-law for the fourth or fifth time in the last 2 years, and she was wiped out of moving mother-in-law. And no place they put her worked. She was disappointed. She was unhappy. And she just moved her again and took her another 4 or 5 days, picking up everything. And she'd express, I'm just exhausted from moving mother-in-law, or whatever the person was. And this lady said, I've got something for you. And she took a thing out of her purse, one sheet of paper. And it was talking about how blessed we are if we can serve the people in need. And it was just, and she put her name on it. And she says, I want you to have this, and I want you to read it every day for the next week. Well, 6 days later, I run into her again, and she's talking to a group of women about her life was transformed by a piece of paper. Well, the lady that gave her the paper was not thinking, I'm out to change your life. That wasn't her first thought, although she was reaching out to say, I care, and this might help you. We need to realize that God gave that piece of paper to that lady. That lady passed it on to somebody else. She may have had it for 15 years in her purse or in a notebook or someplace else, and at the right time, it touched somebody else's life. We've got to be intentional. God is giving something to me. I've now got a responsibility to give whatever I've got to somebody else. They take what I've got, which they would say maybe came from God, and they do the same thing. The world has changed one-on-one. The 12 disciples in the first century did not have the internet and Zoom calls, and they did not have huge crusades in the Middle East and Jerusalem. It was one-on-one small groups that transformed the world. And if we have a success in our political environment and we get more time, great. I was talking to, I'm coaching a church right now, a Chinese Mandarin church in their governance mold, because that's one of my expertises. And she said, you know, and she's speaking from a Chinese person watching the American culture. She said, we are unorganized according to the West, but we've been in the underground church for 50 years. And she said, we're learning how to get more organized in the West. That's where I was helping her. But she says, it's not that we don't have spirituality in depth, because we've been doing it in small groups and in behind the scenes. The underground church is phenomenally extensive in a country like China. It's huge. And it's far bigger than what we've got here. And we're all organized with all the media in the world. You know, so I think it's, again, God to people and people to people, and how he works in your culture, your family, your circumstance is different than what he's going to do in mine. And I think, you know, when you mentioned Christian leaders, I think a lot of Christian leaders, in my experience, were more interested in the money than they were the people that came and gave money. And they were needing money to meet a budget, to report to a board. I understand all of that. I've lived for 30 years in that side of the coin. But their concern was, in fact, I had one major Christian leader tell me, I was trying to help him understand something 30 years ago. And he stopped me in the middle of my conversation with him. He said, Larry, I know all this is important, but I need money right now. I do not need more teaching right now. No, he really needed more teaching, because he was looking at it as a formula to extract from somebody else. And he was leading hundreds of people in ministry, but he was very shallow in what he was doing when it came to engaging partners. And I think, you know, we never get away from that. But I think a lot of Christian leaders are under the gun from a board that doesn't understand ministry. They're under the gun from other history or tradition, whatever it is. And they end up making a mess out of things, because it's all about the bottom line. It's manipulating scripture. There's a whole culture in our culture today that says, we'll make the Bible say whatever we want it to say to get you to give money. And that's manipulation big time. It's called deception. I've dedicated an entire chapter on dissecting deception, so that you as an individual can identify when you're being deceived. When I was first working on the chapter, I was ready to list out a lot of names. I thought, nope, the names are not important. The names in Africa, you couldn't pronounce. The names in America, you all know. The names in Latin America, you've never heard of. They're all deceivers. If I can help you as a believer start to understand how you're being deceived, then you can counteract that by your wisdom that you're going to gain. And there's a lot of that going on. If I, you know, there's a lot of very wealthy Christians that have got wealth through deception. And I'm not for that at all. And that's not the language of where I'm coming from. In fact, I'm trying to help people learn the principles behind deception so they can identify it all by themselves. And but I think a lot of times we get into those kind of modes in order to get the bottom line buck faster. And, you know, the enemy of our soul is out to blow us apart and use deception. In Genesis 2, deception was big time. He misquoted scripture of what God said to Eve, and Eve bought it. And the message from Genesis 2 all the way through today is the message is the deception is out there and it's big time. And we Absolutely. Need to be wise about all of that.
So question for you, and then we'll probably wrap up here. So question for you, do you have a few chapters in there that are specifically dedicated towards the leaders and how to set up this stewardship system in their church or their organization so that, that they can roll it out? So not just principles, but the practicals for the pastors and leaders to roll out stewardship.
There would be some of that, particularly when I tackle issues that they think is stewardship. I dedicate, I think it's toward the end of the book, but I dedicate a whole chapter to money. Mm-hmm. That's the first time I bring up the subject money in the entire book, because the expectation, if you see a lifestyle stewardship, this is a book about how we get money. And I'm saying, no, you got to start looking at individuals as stewards. Now we'll talk about money because money's tangible.
Yeah.
Money you can see, you can exchange, you can see it on the bottom line, you see it on the budget. There's a place where money fits in, but money is only one of 100 things that you can give away. And so there's a practical side of, in fact, I tell a lot of leaders, if you get into this kind of content and you help your leadership build around this content, you're going to have a thriving crowd that wants to give to you rather than a crowd that's trying to hold back from you. So there's both principles, and that's why the book is in two sections. The principles are theological. A pastor could preach on one of those principles for 9 weeks. The practicality of that is getting, now that you understand the principles, how are you going to roll it out? And we've got to address money as one of those things, because that's what you thought the book was about in the first place. But Beautiful. Then we go into, in one chapter, I go into a chapter where this whole idea of stewardship, you know, the money part fit together. How does it start it and where does it go? And that is helpful. I think helping people identify their own deception is very helpful so that you're not being manipulated by outside influencers. Just because they're good on television does not mean they're biblically accurate. You know, so there's a lot of things out there like that. And half the book is practicality. But if you miss the principles before you come to the practicality, you end up becoming a manipulator. And I don't want people, I want the leaders and the organizations that I've worked with over the years, when they start to realize that this is a togetherness game, not how do I get more of you to manipulate to get my needs met. I ran into a few Christian leaders that say, I really don't want the partners or the donors, they would call them there, to be involved in our ministry. When they give us the money, it's our responsibility to spend it. And I'm saying, oh no, a steward is responsible for the outcome. And if they start asking you hard questions and they tell you they're not going to give to you anymore, it's because you were failing in their expectation. And many ministries would like to just be free of the obligation to be honest with their stewards. And so there's principles like that all the way through. I'm not trying to write anybody in a tough way. I'm just trying to help people think right so they can biblically fund their need, but more so that they can help their people be free to be what God wants them to be. And if you got people free to be what God wants them to be, you're going to have generosity all over the place, all kinds of generosity. Absolutely.
Larry, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for joining us today. If folks want to purchase the book, where do they find you?
The book, you can go to Barnes & Noble, you can go to Amazon, you can go to any place that you buy books. It's called Intentional Living and Giving. And the intentional part is very important there, Sean, because intentionality is where this all starts. I choose to do this. It's not that you just all of a sudden trip over it, because there's going to be a decision is, I will fulfill the job description that I read about, and I will be what God wants me to be, and I can do this with a lot of fun. And you can get it any place. You can go to LarryOnan.com and find the books there. And in fact, I think it's still up there now. If people go to LarryOnan.com right today, they can click on it and get a free download to their web, to their digital device. It's available free to anybody that wants to go get one at LarryOnan.com. A lot of people like to hold their book, but a lot of people want their iPad or their Kindle or whatever they use to read it. They can download it there. the book is available for free if that's where they want to go get it.
That's awesome. Larry Onan, thank you so much for
Thank you very much, John, for the opportunity to share today. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you very much.
Blessings on you.
Yes, and you as well. This has been great. It's been a learning experience for me. It's good to get to know you. And I wish we had more time, but I'm time constrained. So I just want to say thank you. This has been a real blessing, and I appreciate you.
It's a blessing for me to join you today, Sean. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Exceedingly podcast, where we shine a light on the good works God is doing through Christian business people, authors, speakers, and pastors. Talk about practical ways we can all let our lights shine and glorify Christ on earth.